Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're plunging into what can be really murky waters. Interstate child support.
Yeah.
You know, what happens when parents are in different states? There's a support order. It sounds straightforward.
It really doesn't always turn out that way.
No, it can get surprisingly tangled. So to help us navigate this, we're going to look closely at a specific case. Hamilton v. Hamilton. It's a 2009 Indiana Court of Appeals decision. Think of it as our guidepost for understanding these cross-state legal fights.
Exactly. Hamilton is it's a perfect example of that friction you get when one state tries to enforce another state's child support order. The big question really is, can the new state, where, say, the paying parent now lives, can they actually change the deal? Or do they just have to follow what the first state decided?
That's the core tension, isn't it? One state sets the amount, then someone moves. Can the new state just say, we'll do it differently now? And generally, as we'll see, the answer is usually no. Which brings us to the really key legal stuff governing this. We're talking UIFSA, that's the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act.
Crucial piece of legislation.
And also that bedrock legal idea, full faith and credit. You know, states have to respect each other's court decisions.
And there's actually the Full Faith and Credit for Child Support Orders Act, the FFCCSOA, which really zeroes in on this for child support specifically, makes it clear states have to honor these orders.
Okay.
These laws are basically designed to stop support obligations from just, well, vanishing if a parent hops over a state line.
Mm.
And a concept we absolutely have to unpack is continuing exclusive jurisdiction.
Bit of a mouthful.
It is,
yeah.
But it's so central to understanding how this works.
Definitely. So in our case, Hamilton v. Hamilton, we have Suzanne. She's the custodial parent, lives in Florida with the kids. Richard, the non-custodial parent, he's moved to Indiana.
Okay.
Florida had already issued a child support order. Suzanne goes to Indiana to get that order enforced because that's where Richard is now.
Makes sense.
But at the same time, Richard asks the Indiana court to actually lower his payments. So you've got Florida's order, Indiana's courts, and this legal tug of war. Let's get into it. What's the background here?
Well, what's interesting is the history was already set in Florida. They divorced there back in 2005. Florida gave Suzanne custody and importantly ordered Richard to pay $1,473 a month in child support.
Okay, a specific amount set by Florida.
Exactly. And the timeline matters. Richard quickly started falling behind. By early 2006, a Florida court had already found him in contempt for not paying.
So Florida was already chasing him, basically.
They were. They even threatened jail time unless he paid up a chunk of what he owed and got on a payment plan. So Florida was actively enforcing its own order right from the start.
Right. So they were engaged. Then the plot twist, Richard moves to Indiana. What does that move immediately mean for enforcing that Florida order?
Well, Suzanne did the right thing. She used UISA's procedures to register the Florida order in Indiana. That's UISA in action, really. It gives a clear path for one state's order to be legally recognized and enforced in another state. Once it's registered in Indiana, Indiana's courts can use their tools, their legal processes, to make Richard pay what Florida said he owed.
Which sets up the main fight in the case, right? Richard's now in Indiana, and he goes to the Indiana court saying, hey, my finances have changed. You need to lower my payments.
While Suzanne is saying, nope. Enforce the Florida order as written.
Exactly. So the Indiana court is caught. Do they just act like a collection agency for Florida, or can they actually listen to Richard and potentially change the amount?
And this is where that continuing exclusive jurisdiction, let's call it CEJ, really comes into play.
Okay, CEJ.
Under USS, the rule is generally that the state that issued the original order, Florida, in this case, keeps the sole power to modify that order.
Sole power.
Generally, yes, as long as one of the parents or the child still lives in that original state.
Ah, so because Suzanne and the kids were still Florida residents.
Precisely. Because they were still in Florida, Florida held on to the CEJ for modification. Now, there are exceptions, like if everyone moves out or if both parents agree in writing to let another state modify it, but that wasn't the situation here.
Okay, so Florida keeps the power to change the amount. Indiana, where Richard lives now, it has the power to make him pay, but not to mess with the number itself. Is that a fair summary?
That's a very good way to put it. The Indiana Court of Appeals in Hamilton was really clear on this. They said Indiana could enforce the Florida order, use its powers to collect the money, but its authority to modify the, quote, amount, scope, or duration of that obligation was severely limited.
Because Florida had CEJ.
Exactly. Because Florida retained that continuing exclusive jurisdiction. Unless those specific transfer conditions were met, Florida was the only state that could change the 473-year-old figure.
Okay. Now, digging into the Hamilton case details, the Indiana trial court did find Richard in contempt for not paying according to the Florida order. But then they did something interesting. They sort of put his jail sentence on hold if he made reduced payments. Suzanne argued that this was basically Indiana modifying the order through the back door. What did the appeals court say about that?
Yeah, that was a really sharp point of contention. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, the majority on the appellate court didn't agree with Suzanne there.
Oh, why not?
Their thinking was that what Indiana did, finding contempt but offering a way out of jail with partial payments, was still fundamentally about enforcement.
Mm, explain that.
Indiana was using its own tool, its contempt power, to pressure Richard into complying with the existing Florida order. As long as that original $1,473 monthly obligation was still legally the amount owed.
Which it was.
Which it was. Indiana's enforcement tactics, even if they involved, you know, temporary relief from punishment for making some payment, weren't seen as changing the actual support amount.
Okay, so it's like the difference between saying you legally owe $100 versus saying, if you give me $50 right now, I won't take you to court today. The underlying $100 debt doesn't change.
That's a perfect analogy. It's the distinction between the how much the 1473 error set by Florida and the how, the methods Indiana uses to try and get compliance.
So Indiana was managing the how with its contempt powers, but it didn't touch the how much.
Precisely. They weren't altering the fundamental obligation determined by Florida.
That makes sense as a legal distinction, but there was another wrinkle, something about the Federal Consumer Credit Protection Act, FCCPA. What was that about?
Yes, that was another important part. The Indiana trial court, in its decision, had mentioned the FCCPA and its limits on wage garnishment.
Okay, like how much you can take from someone's paycheck.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the rule that often limits garnishment for support to, I think it's generally around 55% of disposable earnings in many cases.
Right.
The appellate court said bringing this up in the context of the total obligation was an error by the trial court.
Why was that wrong? Garnishment seems like a standard enforcement tool.
Oh, it absolutely is. Wage garnishment is very common. But, and this is key, the FCCPA limits how much can be taken out of a paycheck at any one time.
Okay.
It does not put a ceiling on the total amount of child support someone owes, including all the back payments, the arrearages.
I see the difference.
The Indiana trial court seemed to imply that maybe Richard's total debt was somehow capped by these garnishment percentages. But the appellate court smacked that down, saying, no, Richard still owed the entire arrearage built up under the Florida order.
Regardless of how much Indiana could legally pull from his check each pay period.
Exactly. The FCCPA governs the method and immediate amount of collection through garnishment. It doesn't magically reduce the total underlying debt. He owed every penny Florida said he owed.
So the trial court mixed up the mechanism of collection with the actual amount of the debt, and the appeals court corrected that.
That's right. They specifically reversed the trial court on that point. Richard was fully liable for the whole amount ordered by Florida, arrears and all.
Okay, so let's try to pull together the big takeaways from Hamilton v. Hamilton. It feels like a really clear illustration of how this interstate system is supposed to work.
I think so, too. First, clearly, Indiana could enforce Florida's order once it was properly registered there. They had the power and the tool.
Right. Enforcement was okay.
Second, and this is the big one for interstate law, Indiana generally could not modify the amount of support. Why? Because Florida kept that continuing exclusive jurisdiction, the CEJ, since Suzanne and the kids still live there.
And that core distinction, enforcement versus modification, seems absolutely critical. Enforcement is the how you get paid. Modification is changing the how much.
Perfectly put. Indiana could use its enforcement tools, like contempt, to manage the how, but it couldn't mess with the how much set by Florida.
Even the contempt ruling with the partial payment option was seen as enforcement, aiming for compliance, not modification.
Correct. And finally, that FCCPA point. The wage garnishment limits are about the process of withholding from a paycheck. They don't reduce the total debt owed, including all the back support.
This case really underscores why UEFSA is so important, doesn't it? It gives us these, well, relatively clear rules for handling support when parents are in different states.
Absolutely. It's designed specifically to stop parents from just moving to try and dodge their obligations or get a better deal in a new state without going through the proper channels, usually back in the original state.
Right.
And the practical takeaway for a custodial parent is pretty significant. They can generally go after enforcement across state lines, feeling fairly confident that the new state isn't just going to rewrite the support amount.
The original order usually holds strong.
Generally, yes. The order from the state with proper jurisdiction should be respected and enforced elsewhere.
So, for our listeners, especially the law students tuning in, maybe pause and think about the why behind these rules in UFSA and FFCCSOA. You know, how do they try to balance things? The need for kids to get reliable support versus, say, state sovereignty or fairness to the parent who moved.
That's a great point for reflection.
What kind of tricky situations or maybe complexities could still pop up when you try to apply these rules to different sets of facts? It's definitely worth mulling over.
Indeed. And just remember that key lesson from Hamilton. Enforcement and modification are distinct legal concepts with very different jurisdictional rules under USA. Getting that distinction right is, well, it's fundamental in this area of family law.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks for walking us through that case.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.